This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt. Jump in.
I'm a Barbie girl in the Barbie world. Life in plastic, it's fantastic.
Let's go party.
So there are all types of Barbies. There's marine biologist Barbie, park ranger Barbie, firefighter, dancer, doctor, astronaut Barbie, all under the banner of aspiration and representation. And over the years, we've seen Mattel introduce Barbies with different disabilities. And the latest has been called a watershed moment by some in the autistic community with the release just yesterday of Autistic Barbie. So this is a Barbie with noise-cancelling headphones, eyes slightly to the side so she doesn't have to have direct eye contact with other Barbies, and her accessory is a fidget spinner. So is Autistic Barbie a genuine move for inclusivity or just a way for one of the world's largest toy makers to sell more Barbies? From wheelchair Barbie, Down syndrome Barbie, diabetes Barbie, and now Autistic Barbie, is it important for a doll once known for its tiny waist, big boobs, blonde hair, white skin, and a desperate boyfriend called Ken to represent everyone? And do they do it well? Is it inclusivity or is it stereotyping? And also this hour, how long is the grass and how unkept is the vegetation on the side of the roads where you drive?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Hi, Barbie.
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 So there are many types of Barbies, but there are also over 600,000 Australians who are autistic. And we've just seen the launch of Autistic Barbie. So how has she been received by people who live with autism? And do autistic kids want to play with a Barbie who looks like them? But then the bigger question is, what does autism look like? And did Mattel get it right in the choices they made about what she looks and what she carries? This. I'm an autistic woman. I find it patronising. I don't need a Barbie. I need workplace accommodation. I need a society-wide acceptance. I don't need a doll that reinforces body standards. Weird Barbie from the movie is the closest representative of the actual community. So what do you think? Dr. Clem Basto is a critical autism studies researcher, a screenwriter, and the author of Late Bloomer. Clem, what was your first reaction to this Barbie?
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Look, I have to say, very excited. Now, I mean, I need to preface that by saying I am one of the dreaded so-called adult doll collectors. But I think what's really important about this doll is to remember that particularly the fashionistas, and she's a fashionista doll, which are the Playland dolls, they're pretty affordable. They're for kids. And I think for kids to be able to look to a doll like that and go, she's like me, or she's like my sister, or she's like my friend from school, I think that is a big step in the right direction. You know, like you said in your intro, there are lots of different conversations that we can have. You know, do we talk about whether any of these dolls that are, you know, broadly representative of different communities are a good step, or if they're just a doll selling tool? They can be both. But I think what's really important with this doll is that they have designed her in collaboration with ASAM, so the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. So it's been a very autistic-led process, which I think really bears repeating. Because I think some people may be worried that Mattel have just gone, we've decided this is what autism in inverted commas looks like. But it has actually been quite a collaborative development process, which is important to remember.
So let's talk about the accessories, because Barbie's all about the accessories. How did you feel about this? There was headphones, the eyes of Autistic Barbie are slightly to the side so that she doesn't have to get eye contact with, you know, Ken or another Barbie. Who wants to get eye contact with Ken anyway, right? Let's face facts.
Poor Ken.
Poor Ken. And then there's the fidget spinner, which is the the accessory for this Barbie. Are these the right accessories?
Look, what's really important about this doll is that she has an AAC device. So that is augmentative and alternative communication. So the thing about the autistic community is a lot of autistic people can't rely on spoken speech to communicate their needs all the time or at all. But they're really rarely represented. If we think about what we see in media, you know, we've only really recently in the last few years kind of moved beyond that idea of, you know, autism being represented by the Good Doctor or, you know, Sherlock on BBC. So I think the fact that she's got an AAC device is really huge. And there's been a lot of commentary, which I would kind of characterise as bad faith, which is people saying, well, she doesn't look like me, autism doesn't have a look. And that is true. You know, there isn't a physical attribute to autism, but there are support tools that people use, which are very much identifiable, you know. And so for this doll to have those noise-cancelling headphones, to have the AAC device, I think that is big because they are things that kind of mark a person as if you want to put it that way, visibly autistic. And so for the people who can't get through life, you know, without relying on those things, I think that's really big. You know, not everybody has the privilege to be able to mask, to be able to, you know, go to the shops without headphones on. So I think that aspect of the accessories is great. You know, some people have said, well, couldn't they have just made an accessories kit? And I suppose that's a fair argument. You know, could you go and get...
There's still time.
In the same way that you might go and get, you know, a fashion pack that has like a sports outfit. But I think the fact that it's, you know, this doll is autistic, you know, canonically, I guess, if you like, and that she has those accessories is a really big deal. Because, yes, it's true. You can't tell just by looking at someone if they're autistic. But if they're using an AAC device, you know, if they have noise-cancelling headphones on, if they have a fidget spinner, if, you know, they are things that kind of mark you as more visibly autistic. So I think that is a big deal.
1-300-222-774. If you or someone close to you is living with autism, how did you find the release of this Barbie? Did you think it was a good idea? And is it something that you would buy for a young person in your life? I mean, I say young people, young person. This is what I find interesting, Clem, is as an adult, do we look at autistic Barbie through the eyes of an adult saying, gosh, I wish I had this Barbie when I was little? However, if you really put yourself into being 6-year-old Clem again, would you want a Barbie that looked different to other Barbies, or would you just want your Barbie to look like Barbie?
Short version is yes. And, you know, I'm a white autistic person, but I grew up in a time when, for whatever reason, you know, the shops thought that they only needed to stock white Barbies. And despite that, you know, in the 80s and 90s, Barbie did have quite a diverse range of friends. It's much better now. And I think kids like their dolls to reflect their communities. And there are obviously dolls that kids play with, like Monster High, you know, where they, if no one's friends with the Abominable Snowman, and that's fine. That's, you know, pure fantasy. But for me, when I sort of think about how the kids I know play, how I used to play, you know, you want those storylines to kind of reflect your life. And for most kids, that means a very diverse community of people who have different cultural backgrounds, you know, different disabilities. And so that is something that I really love about the Fashionistas being so diverse. You know, for me as a grown-up doll, how do I put it, doll collector, but I also use dolls to do like 6-scale kind of storytelling. I have this very kind of, you know, on and off project that I do. And so when I'm taking photos of those dolls, I want that to represent the world that I see around me. And so that's a very diverse one.
I feel like there's another conversation for another time in this, Dr. Clem Basto.
Absolutely.
I know my hand. Lego is also trying to do similar things. And my daughter was obsessed with Lego. She's sort of slowly growing out of it, which is very good financially, can I just say. And I'm not sure what to do with all this Lego I have now. Maybe there's someone I can donate it to. But I slowly saw a rise of disabilities being included in the little figurines. But then there was weird things like, so you'd buy these kits where they would build like a cool cafe or house or something. And one of the friends, this group of friends, was in a wheelchair or maybe was an amputee, I can't remember. But the house that they built and this cool apartment that they built, it didn't have a ramp. So
yes.
I was like, well, and then I was like, oh, Rishi, back off, have some fun. It's Lego, for God's sake. So, you know, where do you draw the line in it being real and truly inclusive? And when is it just a bit of Lego and just a doll?
Look, it's hard to say. I think both things can be true. And, you know, this is something that we've seen for those of us who've been paying attention to Barbie for a long time. Back in the 90s, Becky, who was a wheelchair user, you know, famously her wheelchair didn't fit through the doors of the dream house. That's changed now. You know, any Barbies that are wheelchair users, they come with a little ramp. So you can just plug that into whatever playset you've built and, you know, she can come inside. I think, you know, a lot of these conversations happen through this lens of us as adults,
yeah,
you know, and what yeah. we think kids are doing. And often when you go to kids and show them this and say, what do you think of this doll? They're just like, cool, that's like my friend, blah, blah. And then they yeah. just wander off and, you know, autistic Barbie's flying a plane and, you know, somebody
that's
else.
It. Or getting her hair cut off and her face drawn on like every other Barbie. Let's have a chat with Greg, who's called through from Elberfeldy. Hi, Greg.
Oh, hey, g'day. Look, thanks for your time. There's two things I really want to say. First of all, Clem, your book is good. I've read it. It's for my daughter. She's been diagnosed as autistic with ADHD. I'd also like to say that the audiobook was on the ABC app. And I think congratulations to the ABC for putting these books available for everybody on the app. So that's the plug for the ABC. And my only other comment is great idea with Barbie, but it's I just noticed that in my own personal experience, autism and autistic traits are so diverse, and so many different shades, you know, of and different ways of hiding it, masking it, and presenting it. But it's really, you know, next to impossible to do that. But I suppose if that's Mattel's marketing strategy, that's a good thing to get some. But it's, like I said, it's a bit of a danger that it will be recognised as being the norm, if you know what I mean. This is what it looks like.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Greg, because there's a text here from Ali, and it says, as an autistic woman and mother of an autistic daughter, who don't use fidget spinners or headphones or wear sensitive fabrics or stable shoes, I find this doll just perpetuates harmful stereotypes. As a teacher of decades of autistic girls, I wonder where this autistic doll is, who she lives, what she loves reading and dresses up as her favourite character, programs, computers, who plays board games. Pink fidget spinners feel so superficial, emphasising the disability instead of the ability. What do you make of that, Clem?
Look, I think it's important to emphasise the disability. I think a lot of discourse around autism of late can drift into the superpower kind of narrative, which is also not helpful. You know, I think we had many decades of autism as this terrible thing that is, you know, ruins families and it's an awful burden. And then the flip side of that was autism is my superpower. The reality is somewhere in between for pretty much every autistic person. You know, we have varying support needs. It's a dynamic condition. It can be different day to day. It can be different hour to hour. And I think what's important to remember about this doll is it's just a start. You know, it's not saying this is the autistic person. Nobody else is autistic if they don't look like this or if they don't use these things. But it's a way to say, okay, we're going to start representing autism with dolls. And for the record, there are other dolls that are canonically autistic. Twyla from Monster High is autistic. The actress who does her voice performances is also autistic. So it's not, you know, there are other dolls that have, I suppose, more of a, if you like, a kind of character bio. I suppose with the fashionistas, they're a playline doll in that you kind of bring the story to them. But there might be some kids who buy her and just go, cool device, and then just decide
that's it, exactly.
Somebody totally different, like.
That's it. Like this one says, good grief, they're dolls. Children use their imagination and they just make it work. Imagination is the key. We don't encourage that dream time enough. We just fill their days with organised activities. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. Just finally, Dr. Clem Bastow, how many Barbies did you have growing up? Because that was a real status symbol too, wasn't it? Whether you had one Barbie or, you know, multiple Barbies. You were rich.
I was a latecomer. I was a latecomer to Barbie, and I remember Father Christmas brought me one when I was, I think, think about 8 and a half, and I was actually quite scared. I remember sort of burying her under my pillow and kind of wandering downstairs and saying to Mum and Dad, look, I'm thinking maybe this year I might look into Barbies. And of course they were like, oh, great idea, you know. I was a big fan, but you know, for me, my Barbies all ended up as weird Barbies. They were, you know, kind of paramilitary. They would parachute off the roof of the house, and then they all got haircuts, and eventually they were my models going into fashion school. So I think, yeah, you know,
creative Barbie. Reinvention Barbie.
And I think it's really nice that autistic kids now, you know, that there's a doll that they can kind of point to in that imaginative play to be like, she's like me or she's like my friend.
Thanks, Barbie.
Thanks, Barbie.
Dr. Clem Bastow, critical autism studies researcher, screenwriter and author of Late Bloomer. What do you think? There's autism Barbie. Should there be more dolls, in particular Mattel? Should they be releasing more Barbies who do have disabilities? We've seen a handful of them now. And do we look at them maybe in a positive lens through the eyes of an adult? But if you're a kid, is that the Barbie that you want? Maybe it is. Would you buy it for a young person in your life? Whether it be wheelchair Barbie, Down syndrome Barbie, diabetes Barbie, now autism Barbie. Cheryl's in Q East. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Rochelle. I think this is so far off the mark. Basic point for starters, by far the majority of people with autism are male, so perhaps it would have been more appropriate to do
Ken.
Rather than autistic
I thought the same
Barbie.
Thing. Yeah.
Look, I'm the mother of a profoundly autistic adult also, and I can actually see as much harm as good coming from this, because it perpetuates the view that we're hearing more and more of these days, that like concentrating on the positives. And yes, that's great. Yes, that is great. But there is a large cohort within the autistic community, the male autistic community probably in particular, who are nonverbal, who are not interested in looking glamorous, etc., who have a profound disability. And to me, this actually misrepresents the diversity of autism. So I couldn't believe it when I heard this.
Yeah, right. Seen
the doll, but yeah.
Cheryl, what about this? Right, this is the text that says perhaps some of the proceeds could go towards supporting autistic people or organisations that support this community. That might send a message that it's not just about profit. Would that take any of the sting out of it for you?
Perhaps a little bit, but I don't think it gets away from those basic points that I made about most people with autism being male and the spectrum being so diverse and totally ignoring the people like my son at the profound end.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much for calling through, Cheryl. I really appreciate it. I love this. I had a friend whose young daughter was incensed that Barbie had no body hair. So she drew it all over her legs and under her arms, etc. Oh, I love everything about that text. What have you done to your Barbie? Now, there's another conversation as well. When you drive on some of your main roads in and around where you live, especially if you drive for a living, what's the grass like on the side? How high is it? What are the trees like? How close are they? How dense is the vegetation? And would you like to see it better kept? And would you like to see some of it removed? This from Anonymous in Pasco Vale. Rochelle, grass heights on roadways is one thing, but then there's the weeds and there's the rubbish on prominent roadways as well. Even in Metro Melbourne, it's a slight on all of us. No pride in our public spaces. Well, do we need to reduce the amount of shrubbery, the amount of grass and the amount of trees on our major roads when it comes to bushfires?
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is an interesting question. It's from Keith and it says, do Mattel have a wide range of Kens? Yeah, I don't know. I think there's just Ken, hence the song, I'm Just Ken. I mean, there was Little Ken and Big Ken. I'm sure they had different names, you know, Junior Ken. Now, some of the grass just on the edge of the Hume Freeway near Longwood, where the fire occurred, is apparently longer and higher than the state's fire prevention guidelines. We know now that an arson squad is investigating whether or not sparks from a truck trailer actually started the fire in that area. But it raises questions for all of our roads and the vegetation along the side of them. Is the grass too long, too dry where you live? Are the trees too close or too low? Is the vegetation too dense? And how often are the sides of your roads cleared? Are they maintained? Are trees and bushes actually well kept where you live and where you drive? Dr. Greg Moore, Senior Research Associate at Melbourne University and Chair of the National Trust of Significant Trees Register. Greg, this will change depending on where you drive, of course, but let's look at grass first. How close and how high should grass be in bushfire-prone areas, do you believe?
It depends on what sort of grass you're talking about, Rochelle. Mm. If you're talking about our native grasses, they are managed in one way, but as one of your texters mentioned, the weeds are introduced. They can get very tall and they can be a real fuel for a fire when they dry out. Most of the people that are listening to this show will know that the road sides and the vegetation on it, where they live has changed over the last 20 years. So, for example, there are far fewer trees along our roadsides than there were, and you've only got to think of the Hume Freeway, for example, or the road to Geelong. Trees have disappeared almost completely for large stretches, and they haven't been replaced by native vegetation. It's weed for the most part. And if you don't slash that, you do have a real problem. But in other places, if you've got native vegetation, some of the remnants of grasslands and the remnants of other plant communities really only exist along roadsides. Mm. We've cleared the state so extensively. So I think the point here is that you've got to manage roadside vegetation. Those roadside vegetations are sort of the ribbons that connect very disturbed ecosystems in Victoria. They provide corridors for wildlife and habitat. So if you don't manage them properly, you really do threaten the ecosystems that dot across Victoria.
Greg, stay with us. John's in Coleraine. Hi, John.
Hi, Shell.
What did you want to say?
Well, I disagree with some of what Greg's just mentioned, because the roads in our area are overgrown with trees so that they create a hazard as you drive down. Trees, branches fall off, block the road. But the vegetation that grows, being grass and weeds, is so high you can't see the wildlife that come out from the farm properties. And that's why there's so many road strikes.
And so it's a combination of trees losing limbs and then vegetation being overgrown in that area. Is this a bugbear for a lot of people in the community? Is it something that has always sort of not been maintained, John?
It's got worse over the years. We've got a road that goes past our property that was cleared fence to fence in 1972. It is now totally overgrown, so that the trees are now touching each other as they compete for the daylight.
Yeah, right. So if they're creating almost a canopy or a tunnel for you. Dr. Greg Moore, I mean, this is in regional Victoria that John's talking about, but yes, in terms of the types of trees that could or should be planted on the sides of roads. I mean, we all know ourselves, especially when you're driving through an area that's impacted by bushfire, the roots of the tree may have been compromised and then you get heavy rain. That is a frightening experience, you know, just crossing Indeed. Everything as to whether or not that tree is going to remain upright. But do we need to look at how we maintain trees on the side of roads?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think John and I are in any disagreement, really.
Yeah.
I think what happens is that, as I said right at the start, you've got to manage this vegetation because it's a dramatically changed part of the landscape. So you can't just let things go, and you can get native vegetation growing way too thickly, almost weedy growth. And when you get native trees and introduced weeds, particularly on the ground layer, what we found in Black Saturday is that the roadside vegetation often slowed the fires. But if you had lots of weeds growing under the trees, then the weeds caught fire and the flames moved up through the canopies almost like a chimney. And so it is about proper a proper understanding of what these roadside vegetations do and how you preserve them as reserves. In many cases, they are really important reserves for the native plant and animal species, but they do have to be managed. And there's no doubt at all that there's truth in what John is saying. For example, even when I'm driving around the state, I often see trees and I think to myself, that should not be there. That tree has died. Parts of the tree have died. Quite often you've got very large limbs that are overhanging roads and you know that they are potentially hazardous. So there is a decrease in the management of vegetation along our roadsides, but it's got to be an informed and sort of proper management. It can't be a simplistic view because, as John has rightly pointed out, you get different roadside vegetation in different parts of the state, and the roadsides are managed in different ways for different purposes. So to give you a simple example, throughout Europe and in parts of North America, they allow vegetation right up to the edge of the road, not as a sort of an environmental matter, but as a traffic control measure, because they know that if there are trees closer to the road, people drive more slowly. Now, we don't do that in Victoria. We clear very large spaces on the sides of roads. And so the way we manage it has an impact on how we behave on the roads, but also on the sorts of weeds that establish.
So what makes people drive slower because there's trees around it? Look, I said at the beginning of the program, I'm kind of wearing my cynical hat today, but I can't imagine that trees on the side of the roads would make Victorians drive any differently and reduce their speed in any way. Well, how does that work?
It's psychological. So, for example, we know that there are lots of calming influences from vegetation. And you've only got to think about this when you're driving. You drive differently in a wooded vegetation, partly because the landscape is changing, so it forces you to concentrate. But there's also an innate sort of awareness that you're near big structures, so you tend to slow down. In the UK, for example, they found they had a debate about whether having roadside speeds and the fines that go with them was more effective than putting trees near the roads. And they eventually asked the local councils, do you want the money from the fines or do you want people to slow down? They said, we want people to slow down. So they put the vegetation closer to the road and it was more effective than speed limits and fines.
Oh, that's interesting within itself. Good morning, Rochelle. The grass in Dingley and Westall Bypass is over a metre high. It's becoming unsafe. Let's have a chat to Sarah in Ferntree Gully. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
I consider the Knox Council to be severely lacking when it comes to this. Last summer, I was watching someone try to cross over Burwood Highway and the grass and weeds were up to their shoulders. There were saplings growing up from the gutters in the centre of Burwood Highway, and this was the entire length, like right up almost to Belgrave.
And that's not a tolled highway, is it? Or is it?
No.
Yeah, okay. Because that comes into it as well in terms of who manages the road and whose responsibility it is.
My understanding is that Knox Council will look after the sides of the roads, but they leave the centre to the state government, which does nothing. Like, you know, every now and then someone will come and give it a very rough buzz cut, but then they just, all of the crap is left everywhere. It clogs up the drains and then we have issues with flooding.
Wow. I mean, that's like living in a household and saying, look, I'll clean the bathroom, but the toilet is somebody else's responsibility. Yeah. When it comes to major roads and grass, like what Sarah's talking about, Greg, what are your feelings there?
Yeah, well, the management standards vary enormously. And Sarah's quite right. Some of the roads are managed by local councils and they have very limited budgets, as you know. Most of them are on the verge of sort of bankruptcy for local government. And the major roads are managed by Vic Roads and the state government. And there's no doubt that the quality of the management of roadside vegetation has diminished over the last couple of decades. There's just not the money going into it that there used to be, but there's also a change in the type of vegetation. So, for example, in some places where the trees have gradually died out because they were very old, fell over, had to be cleared, the vegetated roadside has been replaced by a weedy vegetation that probably requires perhaps two or three management processes each year, whereas they're only getting one. Now, one might have cut it 20, 30 years ago because you had shrubs and trees growing and they kept some of the stuff lower down in check. That's not happening now. So you do have lots of weedy growth. And if you've got a good growing season, particularly in spring, the weeds can grow very, very quickly. And one sort of pre-summer cut will not be enough. You have to do another one.
Just finally, Dr. Greg Moore, I mean, this is something that there's already a very emotional response to this. You know, people are angry, they're frustrated, they're fed up that whatever road it is that they drive on, it isn't maintained, that trees aren't looked after, that weeds aren't dealt with, that grass isn't kept at a certain height. Is it a matter now of lots of people passing the buck and no one wants to maintain this? I mean, do we need just a blanket approach so that it's either just it's the state government's responsibility or it's the council's responsibility and that's that, and one person can manage it and be responsible for it?
Look, in an ideal world, you'd have that situation, but it's just not going to happen, Rochelle. The fact is that you've got different vegetation types across the state that have to be managed differently. Some of them require a local expertise. And in the case of Victoria, funding local government to do some of this work is just inadequate. And so what we demand of our local governments and our state government, for that matter, is often far in excess of the money that we're prepared to pay in our taxes.
Yeah.
So you've got this bind. There is an issue here. There is a lack of resources. There's also a lack of will to do something about it.
Yeah, there's lots of texts saying, are you prepared to pay to have those maintained? But then there's another one that says, the large roundabout in Harcourt, the grass all around that was 4 foot tall and hadn't been cut for months. Greg, always good to get your thoughts on this. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rochelle. Best wishes to your listeners.
Yeah, you too. Dr. Greg Moore, Senior Research Associate at Melbourne University and Chair of the National Trust of Significant Trees Register. Coming up next, if you're a woman over the age of 45, it would be fair to say that your social media feed will be full of people, randoms basically, telling you to lift heavy weights and to start taking creatine. It's all about muscles for us as women as we age. So how quickly do we lose our muscles, and can we ever get them back safely?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, in terms of how long the grass is in the areas that you live beside the road, there's a text here from someone in the Sunbury and Diggers Rest area. It says, this is why we residents are mowing grasses on our roundabouts. So maybe as a resident in your area, are you doing something that the council or the state government should be to keep the grass a little lower? So if you're a woman and if you're over the age of 45, if you're perimenopausal or menopausal, are you being told to lift weights and lift heavy weights? And how many times a week are you supposed to be lifting weights? Are you being told to create and to take supplements that will increase your muscles? And do we really even know why we lose muscles so quickly and how to maintain or how to even get muscles, especially if you're a woman as you age? Well, some research has been done by Deakin University's Institute for Physical Activity and Nutrition. And one of those researchers was Professor Severine Lamont, who's a molecular biologist at Deakin University. Severine, let's start with, okay, 45 and over, if you're a perimenopausal, menopausal woman, how quickly are we losing muscle?
Good morning. So to answer your question in a simple way, quickly.
Yeah.
So basically,
very quickly.
If you compare very quickly. So losing muscle mass, and the more important consequence of losing muscle function, that is losing muscle strength, is a natural phenomenon. So you will see across males and females, and basically what happens as young adults grow, their muscle mass and function sort of peaks at the age of 25, and then a decline is expected up towards the end of the life. So that's a normal phenomenon, and we knew about this. Now, what our study found, and it was the first study to actually examine this phenomenon in females only, is that while this decline happened sort of gradually in males, we found that it wasn't the case in females. And we actually saw that around this age of 45 that you mentioned, it might be a bit earlier, a bit later, instead of a nice gradual decline, we actually have a steep drop in many markers of muscle mass and function. And that was the really intriguing finding of our study, because it means that as women, we become more susceptible to losing muscle mass and function in this age window.
That's why we all of a sudden wake up one day and our arms are just like, when did our arms become saggy? When and how did that happen? At the moment, there is a lot of advice, some of it good, some of it not, on women lifting weights, on creating muscle or on keeping muscle. How much truth is there, do you believe, as a researcher in this space, to older women lifting heavy weights?
There is a lot of truth into this. So we know that to keep our muscle muscly, we need to push our muscles against external loads. So that's basically what we call resistance training. Also, there are other ways to do it. And the more we can keep our muscles under strain through resistance exercise, the more our muscles will not only be maintained, but also will have the chance to increase our muscle mass to an extent as well. So this advice is basically very right, and it becomes especially relevant now that we're speaking about this window of opportunity where females start losing muscle mass at an increased pace, and we need to do something about it.
So before we get into whether or not it's about maintaining muscle, keeping muscle, or whether or not you can rebuild it if it's been lost, why is it important? What if you think, you know what, I don't care. I don't want to look muscly. I'm happy being saggy. Like, is it less about physicality and more about, about how we look and more about how strong we are and protecting us and protecting our bones and falls and all that?
It is much more about how strong we are and much less about how we look. So basically, your muscle strength is what will define your capacity to do everyday tasks as you age. The simplest example we usually use is, imagine the day where you can't stand up from the toilets anymore because you don't have enough muscle mass and muscle strength to help you doing that anymore. So low muscle mass is a very strong predictor of disability, mortality, morbidity, and obviously decreased quality of life towards the end of age. At the same time, people who can maintain more muscle mass have more chances, for example, to survive cancer treatment or chronic diseases that might affect them or any sort of immobilization. Let's think about someone breaking their leg and having to stay immobilized for months. People with more muscle mass to start with have much better chances to found a new quality of life after this type of event. There's also a case for strengthening muscle bone mass, where maintaining muscle mass often goes hand in hand with maintaining bone mass, and we know how important this is, especially for women, especially going through this menopausal transition.
And people need to seek advice and guidance and not just all of a sudden go out and start lifting heavy weights, because it can be dangerous. Like, you need to know what you're doing here. So people need to be really aware of that. Just finally, because I think there's a lot of women who'd be listening to this thinking, okay, yes, I've been getting advice from left, right and centre. Supplements is another big area where, you know, influencers from every aspect of the health industry, and I use the word health industry loosely here, Savine, are supplements helpful?
So that's a great question. And my simple answer to that would be, if you're not an elite athlete, and if you are not injured, there is nothing you can achieve with supplements, nutritional supplements, that you cannot achieve with a normal diet. So it's all about maintaining a good intake of proteins, and not only a good daily intake of proteins, but also to spread it across the three meals. So it's not about having 300 gram steaks at night and nothing else during the rest of the day. It's about maybe having milk and an egg in the morning and something else protein rich as part of your sandwich at midday. and then a little piece of meat at night. So it's really about how much protein you can take in. And this is because the other mechanism that allows our muscle to be maintained and also to be, that allows us to build more muscle mass is protein intake, because proteins are basically the basics of what forms our muscle at the cellular level.
This is why we all wish we had shares in the cottage cheese industry at the moment, which is just going through the roof. It's crazy. It's sold out everywhere. Just finally, this is a question from Eliza. It says, is doing weights or reformer Pilates better to deal with muscle loss?
So my advice would be any exercise is better than no exercise. So some people cannot do resistance training. To your point earlier, some people don't have access to the gym or don't know how to do it. So if you had access to the gym and even better, a trainer that could show you the exercises while making sure you're not getting injured, that's the perfect scenario. If you could do it 2 to 3 times a week, even better. But understanding that this is not possible for everyone, Pilates is a good way to maintain your muscle under tension, even so it might not be as effective for building muscle mass. You might be able to maintain some muscle mass and also to keep some flexibility, which is important as well. But for people with disabilities or who haven't exercised in their life at all and want to start doing something, any exercise is better than no exercise, whether it's a brisk walk.
And some are cheaper than others. You know, there's only reformer Pilates. Then you need to, you know, get a second mortgage out to be able to do that on a regular basis. Really good to get your thoughts on this, Savrine. Thank you. Professor Savrine Lamon, who is a molecular biologist at Deakin University. Some research being done with Deakin University's Institute for Physical Activity and Nutrition, looking at muscle mass in women. It's fascinating. You can just sort of throw those keywords into your search engine and you'll be able to look at that research. Well, no matter where you are in and around the tennis centre at the moment, there are people everywhere. We've got record numbers already and we haven't even really started officially. You know, we're just looking at the qualifiers at the moment. But the wild card is something that many are talking about. For the women's this year, it's Venus Williams. So what do you think of this idea? And who is the wild card for? Is it an opportunity for a player that otherwise wouldn't be able to make it through? Or is it simply about bums on seats for the Australian Open? Is it about creating a fun spectacle for us as viewers? Peter Marakito is a tennis commentator with the Australian Open Radio. Peter, there's a bit of, I guess, debate, so to speak, happening around Venus Williams. Many are wrapped. This is just one person on social media saying, you know, Venus Williams' return to the Australian Open at the age of 45 represents far more than just another appearance on a tennis court. It's a powerful statement of resilience, passion, and a love for the game. A seven-time slam, Grand Slam champion and one of the most influential figures in tennis history. Is it the right appointment to have someone like Venus Williams, do you think?
Hello, Rochelle. Yes, it's an interesting one. And I should point out right from the outset that, Venus is one of 8 wildcards into the draw. So it's not just one person who gets the wildcard, who gets through to the Australian Open, but there's actually 7 other players, and I can talk about them in a moment. But it is interesting. She obviously has spoken to Craig Tiley and said, hey, you know, I'm coming down. I still feel like I'm playing a decent level of tennis. Obviously, she doesn't play the full circuit anymore and kind of handpicks her tournaments. But it's that balancing act between having someone who has had that record, as you read out before, and what she has achieved from the sport versus, you know, her star power as well. There'll be lots of people who will be wanting to come to the tennis over the next couple of weeks and be looking for Venus Williams' name and seeing her maybe not on Rod Laver Arena, but maybe on John Cain Arena or one of the other show courts as one of the draw cards is why people are coming through. And I mean, from my perspective, it's great to see her out here still playing a decent level of tennis to actually kind of earn that spot. Now, whether you like it or not, or whether it's fair or not, she certainly, you know, is training hard. She's playing the lead-up tournaments at the moment. So, look, it'll be great to see her because we won't get too many more opportunities.
No, that's it. Absolutely. I mean, it would be incredible to see her again on the court. I mean, in the past, Peter, how far do the wild card entrants get, really? I mean, is it, do they make it through? Do they get very far?
Well, it depends on kind of the circumstances that they're in at that particular time. So just basically, the whole idea of the wildcard system is to give the tournaments, and this is all around the world, an opportunity to select players who wouldn't ordinarily, with their ranking, be able to get into the main draw of the major. So you could have a player that's you know, like Nick Kyrgios, for example, which I'm sure we'll talk about mm-hmm. in a moment, whose ranking has gone into free fall. So he's ranked well outside what would be the direct entry. So it gives the tournament organisers an opportunity to say, hey, look, we'll give you a spot in this draw. And there's a few sort of caveats to that. I mean, there's a couple of what they call discretionary, where the tournament sits down and goes, right, what do we think is going to be best for our event? But then there's a few parameters that are put in place by the AO to make sure that there's reward for effort. So some of those players that are in the main draw who have got wild cards have performed really well on kind of the secondary circuit, which has been happening across Australia from basically October to December, and will pick up again after the AO. There's an Asian wildcard playoff that actually occurs, where players from across Asia, except Australia, get to compete, and their prize is a wildcard at the end of it.
Wow, so right, okay, I didn't know that.
Then there's a couple that we have with the Australian Open has with the USTA, so the US tennis body, where we get a wild card, Australian wild card into the US Open, they get one into the Australian Open. It's the same with the French Federation as well. So it leaves only a few kind of discretionary spots for the tournament to select players from.
I find that fascinating. Peter Makoto is with you, tennis commentator with the Australian Open Radio. Peter, let's talk Nick Kyrgios. I was reading about him this morning. I was reading some of his comments this morning, and a little part of me went, who is this man? What's happened? You know, he was well-mannered and thoughtful and considered. You know, he was talking about how he wouldn't even put his hand up for the wild card because he believed that Stan deserved it far more, and that Stan Wawrinka deserved it far more than him. He was talking about how important it was for him to be back out there and giving it a crack and being present in some way because he sees himself as a role model. And I think, you know, there was a quote from him that says, I'm trying to be a good role model and show that someone like me is still able to have fun no matter what you look like or where you come from. Has Nick Kyrgios matured?
Oh, you'd have to say yes. I guess it's that kind of reckoning of what is his career. And look, I mean, the big point to make is that the injuries have really crueled what he was able to do. I know I was doing the tournament in Brisbane last week. He was talking about how, you know, 2022, he thought he was the best player in the world. He could beat anyone. But these injuries have come in, and now you're kind of dealing with your kind of sporting mortality in a way that you are closer to the end. He's never said that he wants to play forever and ever and ever. But it's now this sense of, okay, well, what can I give back to the sport? There's no doubt he's drawing the fans in. He was playing at Kooyong yesterday. I think he's competing in a few events in this opening week here at the Australian Open this week. So he'll still be a presence. He's still going to play in the doubles. But what remarkable sort of humility finally to say, look, I'm not going to take a wild card because there's no way I'm going to get through five sets. And even if I do, I'm not going to be able to play the next one.
Well, he was just so brutally honest. He was saying, yeah, I'm just not good enough. I'm just not fit enough. And the idea that, you know, for someone who we all kind of love to hang it on, the idea that he is there now for all the right reasons, even though he probably won't win. Just finally, Peter, we're seeing record numbers already. I mean, we're just in the qualifiers at the moment. There are people everywhere. You know, some of these stadiums are being sold out. Have you ever witnessed numbers like this and enthusiasm like this before?
Nope, not pre-tournament anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, this is my 20th Australian Open, Rochelle, and it's keep growing every year. Every year they keep adding the entertainment. Like the crowds are off the scale, like around 30,000 people coming along to this opening week, because it's not just the qualifiers, but there's all sorts of other activities. The top players are practicing, so people wander in and watch them practice, and then they play sort of matches later in the evening. There's this one-point slam thing coming up. There's so much to see and do. Look, it really has become a festival. It's an event as opposed to just a tennis tournament. And they've done such a great job with that over the years in terms of how they've built that up. And no doubt we'll see at the end. The men's, there'll be a million people plus who have come through the gates. But they're all having a great time, and there's plenty of kids hanging around as well.
Absolutely. Peter, thank you. We might touch base again.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thanks, Rochelle.
Peter Mercato, the tennis commentator with the Australian Open Radio. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.